Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zimmer. It's my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming you this morning by Justin Cheka, who is serving as our worship associate, our director of religious education, Karen Lapidus, and several members of the congregation who are providing us with music this morning in Hal Walker's absence. We're grateful to Wendy Mann for her contributions, and also to Kate Coomerly and Bob Erdman, and some folks who will be helping lead some of the hymns as well. So thank you all for assisting with us today.
I was asked to make a pitch again this year for the stewardship drive, like I have done for the past few years. I was going to work up another song and dance routine, like I usually do, but Brad inspired me to play it straight this year, so I'm going to talk straight from the heart. I'm one of those people that knew I was home the very first Sunday service I attended. Soon after, in my new UU class, I learned that this church is like my family's home in at least one important way. We have to take care of this ourselves. If we don't, there's nobody else to do it. No national organization to make all the decisions, to collect and disperse all the funds. It's our building, our congregation, our voice in the world. It takes our hands, our energy, our talents, and our financial support to keep this church going. Our pledges allow this congregation to keep its commitments to things like paying our staff a fair wage, and paying our fair share to the OMD and the UUA, which in turn provide us with support and have provided us with support several times over the years to help us through our growing pains and to help us repair broken systems and relationships. Not to mention the work they do to provide us with Summer Institute, which is the amazing family summer camp that many of us here enjoy. Supporting this church helps to keep this historic old building open, safe, and accessible, to be a voice for liberal religion here in Kent. Liberal religion, which teaches us to value equality and justice for everyone, caring for our world, and finding our own true spiritual path. I support this church with my pledges because this church has been a loving community for me and my family. A very real lifeline for me after 9/11, and a loving antidote to the sadness and turmoil that surrounded my nephew's suicide. Over the years, people here have brought us meals, sent us cards, and helped my children grow up whole and loved and safe. My first stewardship campaign after I joined the church, Mary Leeson approached me to ask if I had made my pledge yet. I told her no, I hadn't. Wasn't really planning to either. I would just put something in the plate every week. I didn't want to have to make a commitment. But she pressed me, just the littlest bit. Do you think you'll put a dollar in the plate every week? Well, certainly I plan to do that much. Then I said so. Then, she said, would you be willing to fill out a pledge card with $52, a dollar a week? It helps the church to make plans if we know we can count on you for $52 a year. Well, that was my first pledge card. How could I say no? I'm glad now that I made that step. It felt good. Today, I hope you will be moved to support this church too. Help us plan, grow, and reach out. Fill out your pledge card and turn it in today. Thank you.
From Albert Einstein's essay, The World as I See It. The fairest thing we can experience is the mysterious. It's the fundamental emotion which stands at the cradle of true art and true science. He who knows it not and can no longer wonder, no longer feel amazement, is as good as dead, a snuffed out candle. It was the experience of mystery, even if mixed with fear, that engendered religion, a knowledge of the existence of something we cannot penetrate, of the manifestations of the profoundest reason and the most radiant beauty, which are only accessible to our reason in their most elementary forms. It is this knowledge and this emotion that constitute the truly religious attitude. In this sense, and in this sense alone, I am a deeply religious man. And so we light our chalice this morning in celebration of the eternal spirit of mystery and wonder.
I see science in everything. When I look at a flower, I'm amazed by its contours, its pigment, and its physical location within the entire universe. Things as simple as this can fill me with such uncontained appreciation. An appreciation that I have been given the capacity, somewhere in this gelatinous supercomputer, to fathom the beauty of what I'm seeing. Some would thank God, others would thank science. Is it possible to thank both? While science can help explain the world around us, it cannot explain those unbelievable feelings of awe. That tap on the shoulder that says you should pay attention. That something amazing is happening. That there is something beautiful that the universe wants you to know. While I've never felt God tap me on the shoulder, I can tell you that every time I look to the heavens and the receptors in my eyes light with the light that has traveled millions of light years to reach me, I can feel something tapping me, telling me I should pay attention. Come, let us worship together.
To lead us into a time of silence and meditation and prayer, wisdom words from Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's one of Justin's heroes, and Justin shared these with me this week. Tyson is an author, an astrophysicist, and the director of the Hayden Planetarium. In an interview with Time magazine, Tyson was asked, "What's the most astounding fact you can share with us about the universe?" This is what he had to say. "The most astounding fact is the knowledge that the atoms that comprise the life on Earth, the atoms that make up the human body, are traceable to the crucibles that cooked light elements into heavy elements in their core under extreme temperatures and pressures. These stars, the high-mass ones among them, went unstable in their later years. They collapsed and then exploded, scattering their enriched guts across the galaxy, guts made of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and all the fundamental ingredients of life itself. These ingredients became part of gas cloud that condense, collapse, form the next generation of solar systems, stars with orbiting planets, and those planets now have the ingredients for life itself. So that when I look up at the night sky, and I know that, yes, we are part of this universe, we are in this universe, but perhaps more important than both of those facts is that the universe is in us. When I reflect on that fact, I look up. Many people feel small because they're small and the universe is big, but I feel big because my atoms came from those stars. There's a level of connectivity. That's what you really want in life. You want to feel connected. You want to feel relevant. You want to feel like a participant in the goings-on of activities and events around you. And that's precisely what we are, just by being alive." We'll keep silence for a few moments together. And I invite you to join with me now in the spirit of prayer. Where do we come from? What are we? Where are we going? Why do bad things happen to good people? Why is there so much tragedy? Why are there so many blessings? Life is filled with mystery. So much of it we don't understand, can't understand. Our response, at its best, is to feel humble, to recognize again our proper place in the scheme of things, to know that we are merely human, and that gives us hope because it also gives us power. With our humanness, we have power. power to bless the world. There's so much we can't understand, but our power to love is infinite. Our power to receive love, our power to give love, our power to bless the world with love. When we're faced again with things that we can't understand and we feel our powerlessness, let us not forget the power that we do have. Let us not forget the power that we have to bless the world with love. May it be so, and amen.
A reading from Gary Kowalski, a Unitarian Universalist minister and author of the book Science and the Search for God. The meaning of existence is not multiple choice, but if it were, and if life were a test, there might be questions like the following on the final exam. Which of the following best describes our situation here? A. We are cells within the 4-billion-year-old body of a living planet. B. We are partners in an intricate but improvisational evolutionary dance. C. We are great apes, complex yet lovable creatures who can therefore only be fully known through love. Are these scientific questions? Partly. Are they religious questions? Certainly. And the answer toward which many of the most original thinkers in both fields are now trending is D, all of the above. Far from being lost or adrift amid the immensities, human beings are expressions of the same creative energy that kindles the stars. Worshipful beings in a firmament that rightly evokes our feelings of kinship and communion.
So, I've been thinking these last few days that rather than When God and Science Met, a better title for this sermon would be When God and Science Meet. The use of the past tense suggests that there was a particular moment when such a meeting occurred. But the truth is that there have been many such moments in many religious traditions with differing outcomes in differing religious, historical, and cultural contexts. Last week, I talked a bit about the ways in which understandings of God began to change during the period of scientific inquiry that characterized the Enlightenment in the West. I'd like to return to that period for a few moments, not to privilege Western ways of thinking and knowing, but because our own lives have been most directly shaped by that history. It's important to remember that many of the leading scientists of 16th and 17th century Europe were religious people. These are people whose names we know, people like Copernicus, Galileo, and Newton. They perceived themselves as having no conflict between the pursuit of their science and their belief in God. They believed that their scientific discoveries would help propel advances not only in science, but also in theology too. Joseph Priestley, who we learned about earlier in the service from Karen, worked in the same spirit. His thinking was entirely undivided. He moved back and forth between conducting and interpreting the results of his scientific experiments to reflecting upon the theological implications of those experiments. His writing and his preaching gave him opportunities to articulate how his science shaped his understanding of human nature and the nature of God. The popular narrative is that God and science have always been on opposite sides of the debate. But this tiny look back into history reminds us that that's not so. Let's take Darwin as another example. Charles Darwin published his On the Origin of Species in 1859, a full 20 years after he completed the work. Part of the reason he delayed so long was because he realized the theological implications of his science would be very difficult for many people to accept. In fact, when he finally did publish his work, he told a friend in a letter that he felt that he was confessing to a murder by publishing his work. At that time, many people had come to believe that everything that existed in the natural world was originally created by God and existent in the Garden of Eden. Darwin himself held similar views when he began his study. But his science made him revise his idea of God and discard the idea of God as someone who created everything once and for all and instead opened him to a vision of a God who established the patterns and laws by which life then unfolded. Darwin's ideas about God continued to evolve over the course of his own lifetime, such that right before his death, he described himself as agnostic. However, he pointed out that at the time when he wrote On the Origin of Species, his faith in God was as strong as that of a bishop. So he was deeply concerned about whether or not people would be able to use his work to revise their own understandings of God. Of course, we know that some more conservative religious traditions could not or would not make such a leap. In fact, one of Darwin's primary biographers, James Moore, grew up in just such a fundamentalist Christian home in which he learned that Darwin was an enemy of God when he was a child. But even immediately after its publishing, there were progressive religious traditions that did embrace Darwin's work and immediately began endeavoring to apply his insights to their own theology. Unitarians and Universalists were among those who embraced the challenge. Despite the reality, the story that began to be told, though, was a story about conflict between science and religion. In the late 1800s, there were two books published whose titles reflect this narrative. One of them was by a chemist, John William Draper. His book was called A History of the Conflict Between Religion and Science. And the other was by a man named Andrew Dickinson White. His book was called A History of the Warfare of Science with Theology in Christendom. Scott Gerard Princeton is a Unitarian minister who is also a physicist and currently a doctoral student in the history of science. In his own study, he has come to understand these two books published in the late 1800s as essentially setting the tone, constructing the narrative by which we have continued to live. And he sees that narrative as something of a self-fulfilling prophecy, the narrative of this conflict between science and religion. Take as a recent example the controversy over Obama's nomination of geneticist Francis Collins to be the director of the National Institutes of Health. Collins is open about being an evangelical Christian. Though he was confirmed by the Senate, there was great controversy about his nomination amongst the scientific community, with a number of his peers opposing his nomination because of his avowed religious faith. According to a study of scientists in the American Association for the Advancement of Science conducted by the Pew Research Center, scientists are roughly half as likely as the general public to believe in God or some kind of higher power. About 51% of scientists in that academy admit to a belief in God or some kind of higher power, whereas about 95% of the general public avows such a belief. Additionally, the scientists in the academy have much lower levels of affiliation with religious institutions, with about 48% of them having no religious affiliation at all, compared to just 17% of the general public with no religious affiliation. That doesn't really come as a surprise to me, given that the narrative about the impenetrable divide between religion and science is still quite popular. What is surprising to me, though, is the growing interest and support for exploring the connections between religion and science. This is an area of interest that has always had adherence, but which has been gaining more support in recent decades. First, there was the publication of Zygon, the Journal of Religion and Science. Then there was the establishment of the Templeton Prize for Progress in Religion. And then in the mid-90s, the American Academy for the Advancement of Sciences organized its own program of dialogue on science, ethics, and religion. Many of the leaders in these conversations are religious people who are accomplished in the fields of both science and faith. I think it can be helpful to us to explore some of the ideas of God that these people have in order to help us explore our own understandings of God. So we'll take three people this morning. Let's start with Ian Barber, who was a Templeton Prize winner. Barber's a nuclear physicist who also has an advanced degree in theology. He spent much of his professional life teaching in both the religion and the physics departments at Carleton College in Minnesota. He rejects the conflict between science and religion, as well as the sense that each should adhere to their own spheres. Much of his work in recent years has focused on exploring the connections and encouraging dialogue between the two. Barber notes that recent discoveries in astronomy are lending credence once again to an argument for design in the universe. This was a popular argument in the 1700s that was ultimately discarded by the scientific experiments that so many did at that point in time, trying to prove a designer for the universe. And Barber says that the new science that's emerging is giving us opportunities to revisit this idea once again with new lenses. Now, he's careful to say that some astronomers reject the idea of design outright, and that it is, of course, impossible to prove with direct evidence. However, he also says that the chances for our universe to be so finely tuned as to have allowed for the conditions for life is just implausible enough to make a theory of design plausible. Starting and ending there, he argues, can only lead to an absentee God who designed the universe and then went out to lunch. However, he says, if we take that idea of design and couple it with insights from theology, then, he says, then it might be possible to believe that ours is indeed the kind of world where we might expect, that we might expect if an intelligent and personal God was interested in the creation of life, consciousness, and intelligent beings capable of personal relationships. So that's one view. Contemporary physicists revisiting an idea of design, of a God that designed this universe. John Polkinghorne is another Templeton Prize winner who's leading the way in this conversation. Polkinghorne takes a different approach. He is distinguished for his career as a mathematical physicist, which he was accomplished in for many years before he decided to return to the Academy to study to be an Anglican priest. Polkinghorne is advancing a contemporary vision of God which is compatible with the insights of modern science through an idea that he calls divine self-limitation. This idea is that when God brings into being a creation, because God is a God of love, God allows creatures to be themselves, indeed to make themselves. That's how we might theologically understand an evolving universe, he explains. Creation is not God's divine puppet theater in which God pulls every string, but God allows creatures to be themselves. This means that not everything that happens will be in accordance with God's will. And this part of divine self-limitation, his theory of divine self-limitation, is especially helpful in answering the perennial questions of theodicy. Theodicy has to do with the question of why evil exists, why suffering exists, and a world with a benevolent God that so many theologians have wrestled with over the years. Polkinghorne explains that though God does not will evil acts to happen, such as the acts of a murderer, he says God allows murders to happen because God has given human beings free will. Likewise, he says, God does not will the incidence of cancer, but God allows cancer to happen in a world in which malignancy is an unavoidable possibility. God does not allow these things, according to Polkinghorne's view of divine self-limitation, because God is callous, but rather that is because that is how God has constructed the universe, and God will not violate God's own laws. So for Polkinghorne, this understanding of God makes sense and is religiously satisfying in addition to being scientifically satisfying. Divine self-limitation is important to me, Polkinghorne writes, because it is the sort of relationship a loving God would have with creatures, to share with them rather than to dominate them, to interact with the world but not to overrule it. So that's a second contemporary idea of God emerging from this conversation between religion and science. And here's a third. This one comes from Brother Consul Magno, who you might have been introduced to if you watch Stephen Colbert, because he was a guest on the show a few years ago. Guy Consul Magno is a research astronomer and a planetary scientist at the Vatican Observatory, as well as a Jesuit brother. He's one of four Jesuits to have an asteroid named after him. Part of the calling of the Jesuits is to find God in all things. And Jesuits have a rich tradition of working in the world in fields ranging from health and science to education and research. Of the current cosmologists and astronomers at the Vatican Observatory today, all but one of them are Jesuits. So Brother Consul Magno tells a story which helps illuminate his own understanding of God. This story comes from his childhood when he was about 9 years old. He was stuck inside on a rainy Sunday afternoon. His mom, knowing that he was likely feeling stifled because he couldn't go out to play, invited him to play cards. They played rummy. His mom could beat him, of course, because he was only 9 years old, but winning wasn't the point of the game, and even then, when he was just 9 years old, he knew that. He knew that the point of the game was that his mother was telling him that she loved him. And he felt that this was so generous because as a nine-year-old, he felt like if his mom had come up and tried to give him a hug and say, "Oh, I love you, son," he might have just squirmed and ran away. But instead, his mom invited him to play this game. And in a way, Consul Magno says, being able to do science and come to an intimate knowledge of creation is God's way of doing the same thing. It's God's way of playing with us. And it's that kind of play that is one way that God tells us how God loves us. So is it invented, he asks? Of course, it's as invented as the card game. But is it an act of love, he concludes? Yes, it's as much an act of love as the card game. Part of the obligation of being a scientist is being open-minded enough to allow for new truth to refine old ways of thinking. The same, I think, is true about being a person of faith. Whatever ideas we do or do not have about God today, part of what I hope to invite you to with this series, Exploring God, is an invitation to dive more deeply into your own views. I offer these three thinkers as sources for your own reflection. There are, of course, many, many others, and you can invite some of them into dialogue as well as a way of deepening the conversation. And I hope that you will. Because who knows what there is yet waiting for you to discover. Amen, and blessed be. As we take our offering this morning, we have a testimonial from Karen Lapidus.
The Stewardship Committee has asked me to share this testimonial with you to offer some insight on how our financial resources support our program of religious education for children and youth. We are currently serving 62 families, which translates to over 100 children and youth. We offer classes at 8 different levels, including our Sunday morning programming, our 2 comprehensive sexuality education programs, and coming of age. We continue to grow both in numbers and in the depth and strength of our program. In addition to providing supplies and equipment and curriculum and other classroom resources, this year we were able to send 2 adults and 1 youth to the Fundamentals of Healthy Youth Groups training that was hosted by the district this fall. And we are able to offer a partial scholarship for one of our youth to attend the district peer chaplain training in a few weeks. Our proposed budget also asks us to fund a new position, the position of religious education assistant, to be employed 5 hours per week, someone who will deal with the details and the administrative tasks in order to allow me more time to focus on the ministerial aspects of faith development for our children and youth. The money allocated to our RE programs for children and youth is money well spent. It ensures that we maintain this special place where we can support our young people as they gain the tools to live lives of purpose and meaning.
I send you with these words from Sarah Moores Campbell. We receive fragments of holiness, glimpses of eternity, brief moments of insight. Let us gather them up for the precious gifts that they are, and renewed by their grace, move boldly into the unknown. Go in peace.